Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 296 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyrer, your host as usual. Today, my guest is Laura Frederick. Now, Laura is a solo practitioner and entrepreneur. That's hardly surprising as being a guest on this show, but she comes out of big law and out of the commercial world, with most recently a stop at Tesla, of all places, great place to work. And she started her practice to deal with contract law and writing contracts in a way that's a little more achievable or understandable to clients. She comes at it from that perspective. And along those lines, has a hugely active LinkedIn community and has written a book that's available on Amazon. And more importantly, has started a platform called How to Contract, where one can kind of hone in on the practical applications of contract writing and development and make that a resource available to attorneys, to law firms, to businesses, and to vendors in particular. So it's a really interesting platform, and her progress from, you know, going to law school to, you know, big law to solo practice and creating a platform is a great entrepreneurial journey, and I'm happy to share it with you. So without any further delay, here is Laura Frederick. Laura Frederick, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Well, it's a delight to have you with us today, Laura. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So I am a commercial contracts attorney. I've 25 years of experience, including 10 years in law firms and 14 years in-house. I have a small firm where I'm the managing partner, and I also am the founder and president of a practical contract training business called How to Contract.
Yeah, I want to touch base on all of those things. So tell us a little bit, you know, when you went to law school, you know, one of the questions I find that has a variety of different answers is that when you went to law school, did you think you were going to be a contracts attorney?
No, not at all. And actually, I thought I'd just get a law degree and then go do something else because I wasn't one of those people who kind of grew up wanting to be a lawyer. Uh-huh. I never knew a lawyer growing up, and I got to college and all of a sudden I met all these people who, you know, were about the same intelligence as I was. And I had always thought lawyers had to be really, really, really smart. And then when I met all my fellow students.
What a realistic awakening that.
Exactly. It was like, oh, so I could go to law school. And so when I was graduating from college, I wanted to keep going and I just didn't like math or science. So I thought, well, I like words, so I'll do law school. So I went in with the idea, I was very interested in international things in high school and in college. I did multiple study abroad programs, studied international economics as my major in college. So I had the idea I would be this jet setting, you know, executive waltzing through airports and sitting in first class and negotiating international deals. So that's kind of the idea I had, but I didn't know what that was. I had no idea which kind of practice, how it would end up. But I did stay focused on that international piece. And so when I graduated law school, I wanted to find a job that was international. And I graduated in a recession, so that wasn't necessarily that easy. So yeah. I ended up taking the only job I could find that had international, which was a franchise law firm. And so I started the first 3 years of my practice as a franchise lawyer.
Meaning you dealt with franchise law, or it was it in and of itself, the law firm was a franchise?
It was a franchise law practice.
Okay.
So they specialized in helping franchise, both domestic and international franchise companies.
Really? Yeah. Sometimes I think it's hard to think of franchises that are international, but I guess some of the bigger ones for sure, right?
Yeah. No, we did a lot with, you'd sign with a big international developer in a particular region or continent, and they would be in charge of, you know, putting in place the Outback brand or Pizza Hut or KFC. So there was quite a bit of it, and it was really interesting, but it was such a small group of clients, a small number of law firms, and it didn't get me excited. So I had the opportunity to move to technology transactions in the late 90s. And this was right in the middle of the technology bubble.
Sure.
And so it was, you know, lots of recruiters every day. And I was able to kind of have my choice of jobs. I took one, and then I ended up able to transition into big law at Morrison & Foerster as a fifth year attorney, which is relatively rare to kind of take that step at that point in your career.
What is a fifth year attorney? I'm not familiar with that term.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I think with a lot of law firms, they classify us by year. So at least some of the bigger firms, that you'll have the first years, the third years, the fifth years. Ah. It's stuck. I always think of it that way.
Ah, interesting. And then ultimately that led you even to be more ingrained in the business world, right?
Yes. So I was in law firms for a while, and I was doing a lot of tech transactions, supporting technology businesses, primarily with equipment and other things. And then moved in-house after around my 10th year of practice, and with a large energy business that had nuclear generation. It had a trading and marketing that worked with derivatives and commodities. It had a propane company. It had everything.
Wow. So not a trivial fly-by-night group.
No. And it was really fantastic because I got so much exposure to all the different kinds of contracts as part of that team, doing everything from, as I said, I was in charge of the trading desk for the company, which had 80 traders and several billions of dollars of trades every day during the meltdown. So we had counterparts at Lehman, all the investment banks we were doing deals with. And so managing the risk for my company during that process was certainly a trial by fire.
No problems in that area.
Exactly.
You know, at that time, geez, that no stress is the word I was looking for, right?
Oh, it was crazy. Because it was at the time I have four children, and they were all born close together while I was practicing. I never took off. And my oldest, when that went on, was 7, and my youngest was 2.
It's a real glutton for punishment you were at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you develop all this skill around contracting and contract law, which I will tell you was not my strong suit in law school. And ultimately that led you into the entrepreneurial world. Tell us a little bit about how that came to be.
Sure. So I started doing entrepreneurial things as the side gig. I had a friend who was a venture capital partner, and he had these small startups. He liked to do angel investings. So I started working with him really for fun. And it was about starting businesses from scratch and how you create a name and how you file for a company and how you get a mailbox and all those kinds of things.
And just for reference, this is what, like in the early 2000s?
It would have been in the early 2010 or early 2010.
So 2010. Okay.
All right. So between 2010 and 20, 19.
All right. So by that time, we've had, you know, kind of the first iteration of the internet explosion. All the dot-coms had made their money, lost their money, and the survivors were now starting to sort themselves out. And really, entrepreneurship companies, startup companies, were becoming really in vogue quite a bit. And, you know, in the late 2007, 8 towards, as you said, the early 2010s.
Yes. And that was my, and I had never done anything entrepreneurial before that. Mm-hmm. And so this was really my first exposure to how you start a business from scratch, was working with him as an angel investor, taking entrepreneurs who had ideas, and his role was just as an angel investor. So he just got them started and then flipped it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I was working with him for about 4 years and started several businesses, and often was the on the ground person, you know, taking care of all the details that entrepreneurs take care of. Sure. But it was a great training ground and made me very comfortable with the idea of how do you start a business? Well, you just go through the checklist and you do all these things, and it's a lot of steps and a lot of work, but it's not an impossible journey.
And over the course of time, you know, that kind of framework, that skeleton of what needs to be done, while it's unique to different types of businesses, is largely conceptually the same process.
Totally agree. And a lot of it is that first hurdle that you could start a business, because before I started working with this business partner, I had no idea. You know, I'd been a lawyer. I'd advised businesses at that point for 15 years or so. You know, I knew a lot about business deals, but I had never seen or known anybody who had started a business.
You'd never seen it taken from started from the cradle.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, so, it's interesting too, because I think, you know, there was a time where, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry said, you know, I think I could start a business. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of folks, myself included, at times will think, well, no, you couldn't. You know, I don't think you can. And that doesn't qualify as an idea for a business. But, you know, God love you for having the gumption to think you could. And now I think that actually has come to really be the case. More and more people are seeing opportunities that exist. And so the entrepreneurial spirit is, you know, more than a cottage industry. It's a tsunami way of going through business today.
For sure. And for me, a lot of my mindset was more along the lines of imposter syndrome. Well, it wasn't that I couldn't figure it out. It was, who am I to think I could do that? You know, I'm in my little box, lawyer box over here. I do that. I can't go and do these other things. That's not who I am. I'm a lawyer.
Yeah. So here you have this entrepreneurial spirit and kind of awakening washing over your contract law experience, and you decide, well, the easiest way to do that is start my own law firm.
Yeah, it took a little while. I've had some different jobs. I think I mentioned on my last in-house job I had was at Tesla. And it really was the epitome of the best job of my career. I love the people. I love the work. I loved everything about it. It was long hours, but I've never really shied away from that. Mm-hmm. So, but something wasn't right. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And I interviewed at a couple places, and it just didn't feel right. And finally, I did a lot of self-reflection, and I had somebody tell me I needed to spend more time figuring out what I wanted before I made a leap. And this person suggested that I come up with the one word that described what I wanted. Well, I want more flexibility with my schedule. I want to be able to do the things I love. He said, nope, one word. And then I get it down to a couple words. Nope, one word. So eventually I got it to the word freedom as my word. And so it was really useful to settle on that because it's so simple. But it also informs a lot of how I want to live my life, what my goals were, what would bring me joy. So with that concept, I realized what I needed to do was start my own practice and take control of my life, take control of the work I did, the hours I worked, the people with whom I worked. So I put in my notice at Tesla and opened up my firm with no clients. Even Tesla wasn't signing up at first. They did later become a client, but not at first. 8 months of living expenses in the bank. And I'm a single mom with 4 kids with no other parent. The dad's not involved. So it was just me. So it was a little bit scary, but
I'd say.
But I came to realize, I think, as I advanced in my career, that jobs, regular jobs as an employee, are so much riskier than being an entrepreneur and controlling your own fate. Because as soon as I started to figure out how to get clients, how to keep clients, I had multiple clients. So then if one client left, it wasn't the end of the world. I'd have another one come. And so I would no longer had all my eggs in one client basket, which was my previously for 25 years was my employer. I now had lots of different income streams. Even when I just had the law firm, I had multiple income streams, each coming from a different client, which gave me so much better buffer and ability to control and create a steady income.
It's a viewpoint that I think is often overlooked when people step into the entrepreneurial or solo firm area, is that it's so much more expansive. And the opportunities are so much more varied to you than having to please a few people in a large company, whether it be in-house or a larger firm. You're at the mercy of their satisfaction with their job and their role in the company. And that doesn't always align, even though you might be having a great time working for a company like Tesla, there's more freedom out there for you. And that's what was drawing you towards this.
Definitely. And I think keeping that freedom, because even when I was enjoying my job, I was still worried about what my boss said. I didn't post on social media or do much because I thought he might disapprove. I was always I lived in a lot of fear, and I've written posts about, and it's in my book, about how much fear I had for so many years that I would be fired any day. There was no empirical evidence to suggest I'd be fired. I always had good reviews. I always did well, but I just was sure of it. And again, it's a combination of getting used to living in fear, getting used to feeling imposter syndrome, even though all the evidence points otherwise. It's just a mindset.
Well, let me ask you a question that it might be a little bit of a leap, because you haven't insinuated this or intimated this at any level. But my sense is at the time that you were going through all of this, even much more so than today, it's a bit of a good old boy network.
There is definitely that.
And how was a woman received in that world?
You know, I think because I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. And so my view of the world was framed by that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think of boys and girls as having any issues there. Okay. So I tended to be the one who kind of ignored all that and just pretended it didn't exist, except in the cases where I couldn't.
Right.
But for most of my career, because I'm a low drama person and I put my head down and get my job done, I focused more on what I was doing than on kind of that good old boy network.
Yeah, and what was going on around you. Yeah.
Yeah. And if I did really good for you. Work, it would work out. And it almost always did. There were a couple cases where things happened and, you know, I could attribute it to that, but it's, look forward, not backward kind of person.
Right. Okay. So we start the law firm. Now, when you started the law firm, seems to me there's a little bit of I've got some money in the bank, no clients. I'm going to leap off the gangplank here and see what happens. Did you do so you know, from the kitchen table, or did you take space in an office, or how was your vision being implemented?
Yeah, that one was very lucky because I had been working remotely since 2015. So before I joined, I started remotely at SolarCity back in 2015 and then was always remote because I didn't want to move to the Bay Area because I had kids in high school and in elementary school. And so they allowed me to just start remote in 2015, which was very advanced for the time. And and then Tesla, I continued that with when I joined Tesla, I stayed remote. And so it was, I was used to being remote. I was used to working with clients remotely. I had a home office off the kitchen and still do. And that's where I've always worked. And I really enjoy it because, as I said, I'm the single mom with four now teenage boys, young men, and I'm always here. So they don't necessarily want to talk to me all day, but whenever they need me, they can find me.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by Center Stage and the Law Firm Marketing Minute, two great podcasts produced by Spotlight Branding. We're a legal marketing company providing content marketing for law firms that actually works. And we created these shows as a free resource to help lawyers like you learn more about marketing and business development. Every Monday, the Law Firm Marketing Minute arrives with a short 10-minute dose of marketing tips and inspiration to help you grow your firm. On Wednesdays, Center Stage arrives with perspective from other lawyers and legal industry experts to help you tackle marketing and other business development challenges. Check both of these shows out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and more. Both shows make great companions for the law entrepreneur, so subscribe today. Hope to see you there soon.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. For many years, marketing companies have focused on funnels that run for a short time, often leaving dozens of leads behind that didn't make a decision yet. Spotlight Branding has found a better way. It's called a content loop, and it's changing the way attorneys think about their marketing. This system nurtures your leads in perpetuity with quality, evergreen content that elevates your credibility and helps the rest of your marketing actually work. If you're interested in learning more, head over to spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, to learn more about the content loop and how it can revolutionize your law firm's marketing. Spotlight Branding, more referrals, better clients, higher return on investment. If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone. And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. When you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress. So you have the law firm, you're attracting clients. Now, what did you do? You said a while back, you know, as soon as I learned how to acquire clients, was there anything significant that you did in order to bring new clients into the law firm?
Yeah. So I started the first 18 months I had my law firm, 100% of my business was from referrals.
Sure.
It was former coworkers and, you know, somebody said I was good and that was everything. And then in the summer of 2020, the pandemic started and I decided I wanted to see if I could expand my firm beyond just me. And I knew I needed, I had previously focused on my super niche, which is equipment contracts for renewable energy companies, which, you know, it's a great niche, but not many people do that. So it's going to be hard to gather a diverse group of clients. So I focused in on my broader best skill, which is really vendor contracts. It's what I've always loved. It, procurement contracts, negotiating for the customer, it's my favorite. So I wanted to recast my firm and build that reputation. And I was reading a lot about marketing and everything kept saying, show me, don't tell me, show me, don't tell me. And so I said, well, I got to show people that I'm an authority, that I know what I'm talking about when I'm doing vendor contracts or really a lot of the contracts. So I started posting every day on LinkedIn. And where that also started was I had read an idea from someone who did a 30-day challenge. And he said how much he learned and grew by posting every day on LinkedIn for 30 days. And I thought, well, I don't think I have enough for 30 days. I think I have enough for about 10 or so. And so that's what I did. I just started posting every day and I really paid attention to the feedback I got from people. And what I learned almost immediately was they loved when I shared a contract tip. And I'd provide real plain English, very no frills, simple explanation of kind of the job skills that contract lawyers have and the things we know that we've gained over the years, but that a new lawyer or somebody in a different practice area might not know.
Who was your audience then in your LinkedIn community? Were you writing for other attorneys? Were you writing for vendors who had a, you know, equipment to contract to lease with other businesses or businesses themselves who were looking to hire either an attorney or bring on a vendor or all the above?
In a way, all the above and even more. Because okay. I came at it with the attitude of generosity, that if I can focus on giving what I know without holding back, and just share more. I'm a big believer the universe will deliver it back to you in spades. So whenever I go into my community, my family, and just give, it always comes back either in good feelings or in reciprocity. So that was the approach I took. So I didn't focus as much on it. I didn't have an ROI. I didn't have a business plan, content strategy at the beginning. I just thought, you know what, I've been doing this 25 years. I know a lot of stuff. Let me share what I know. And I think it took off because, one, a lot of lawyers don't share the practical side of things because it's a little intimidating. You know, you have to stand up and say, I know what I'm doing. I'm not a law professor. I haven't been studying this 20 years, but I actually know stuff. But I'm sharing what we do without kind of case citations or statutory citations. I'm just talking about kind of the operational ways we work. And so doing that, and then I speak, I'm a regular person. I grew up in a middle-class family. I've always spoken like a regular person.
That comes through clearly.
Yeah. So I used to resist that because I thought,
you got to sound a little more highfalutin to be taken seriously. But
exactly.
Actually, the opposite is true.
And I never would have guessed that me using the word stuff and awesome and, you know, that's totally cool.
And allowing your own personality to be reflected in your writing.
Yes. And I couldn't do that when I was working for other people.
Sure.
And when I had that fear and I had that idea of who I'm supposed to be, and I was trying to fit in a particular mold of what I think they want me to be.
Give us a sense of, you know, what are we talking about in terms of length of a post on LinkedIn, and how did you come up with your topics, or did you just kind of sit down and tap the pencil on the on the pad of paper until you came up with an idea?
Yeah. So I, at the beginning, I just started telling people kind of what I wished I could tell people in my negotiations.
Okay.
Because I'll, you know, the contract lawyers, we just exchange drafts all day. And somebody will make some point that's wrong or stupid. And I'll just really want to tell them off in that moment, but I can't because I'm being professional and I'm representing my clients. So those were the things that I wanted to kind of correct all the counterparty lawyers on, things that I knew that they were getting wrong. So there was a little bit of, so I collected a lot of information that way because I draft contracts all day. So there's always, I'm always reviewing other people's work, seeing things they don't understand. And then I just decided to start you know, basically everything I knew. It was almost like I was creating a practical job aid one day at a time that explained every single provision in a contract, every nuance to it. And so that's the approach I took. And then when I would lose ideas, I just have to look at the contracts I was working on and find new things to talk about.
I think it's you know, indicative of the opportunities that we have as attorneys, because so many people say, well, I don't know what to write about it. How could I possibly write, you know, a LinkedIn post? And I'm assuming this is more than just a few sentences. It's a couple of paragraphs or more every day. I just it's overwhelming, but it is easier than you think. There's a wealth of ideas and information that we all retain and use and reflect upon every day that's useful for other people.
Absolutely. And you think about it, those of us who have been doing it for a while, we charge a higher rate because we know a lot of things. And so what are those things that you know that other people don't know?
Yeah.
And the thing that really helped me get it out of my head is to stop focusing on what do I want to say? What do I know? Because then it's all about me. And whenever it's all about you, you get all your paranoia, all your fears kind of get mixed in and stop that creative cycle. But when I focused on how can I help other people? What do I know? What can I share? I've done this for so long. I know a lot. Let me share what I know to help them. And then the ideas flow because you're not blocked by all your self-doubt.
And the reception is entirely different. When you come from the perspective of me, people see that right away and it's off-putting. But when it's something that clearly shows that you're thinking about the reader, the recipient, and how you might help them, that is what gives people the ability to know, like, and trust you.
I agree. And especially because I didn't put on any airs other than who I am. I just decided I would write in my voice using the kinds of words I use and tell it how I would want to hear it, meaning explain contract tips, explain techniques just the way I'd want to hear. And that really differentiated my post from a lot of other people.
And so that resulted in new business.
It did. So since August 2020, when I started posting every day, it's now 97% of the business I've had, which is multiple clients almost every month, is from LinkedIn and from those posts. Yeah. Because
somewhere along the line that morphed into deciding to write a book.
Yeah. So what I was doing was I was posting every day, and then there was a lot of people who really were excited to get this information because it's really not out there. There's a lot of books on how to draft clearly. There's a lot of books, people who talk at very high level about contracts, but nobody says, like, how should you deal with the indemnified party? You know, how do you decide who's going to be in that? Or which word should you use when you're doing Incoterms? How do you structure that sentence? So it was a lot of granular stuff. And so, I just lost my train of thought.
Well, it became more of a practical tips kind of perspective on how to create a contract. So tell us just briefly about the process of creating the book. Were you taking your LinkedIn writings and kind of repackaging them and organizing them? Or did you just start with a blank sheet of paper and do a brain dump?
So yeah, the book started really on demand from the people who were reading and commenting on my posts. There was a lot of appreciation for them. And I had people saying they were cutting and pasting them, trying to collect them all. And would I publish it in a PDF or, you know, do it, collect them all somewhere for them. Wow. And so I thought, well, I could do that. You know, there's self-publishing. Instead of me creating a PDF and trying to sell it or give it away, I thought, well, I can put it in a book. That way anybody can get it, because I have a lot of international followers. And I figured that would be a lot easier than trying to deal with something else. And so I stopped on November 12th and collected all the tips I had, which was 91 tips at that point. And then just personal topics. So I added some of those in too. And then I published it under the name Practical Tips for How to Contract.
And it's done well.
It has. It sold, I think, about 4,000 copies at this point, which is pretty good for a self-publishing.
Yeah. It keeps you in beer and pretzels, as I'd like to say, but also it provides legitimacy and proof of your skill set, because for whatever reason, you know, a lot of people, they don't even have to read the book. If you just hold the book up, it's a great calling card. Hey, I wrote a book on the subject, and you're instantly recognized as an expert in the field. Now, that's led to some other entrepreneurial endeavors on your part. Tell us a little bit about the platform, How to Contract.
Yeah. So it was essentially a continuation from the post and from the book. Is I had a lot of people asking me to do more training. And so I decided to create this platform, How to Contract, to really focus on the same kind of training I offered in my short posts each day. And that was practical tips, zero fluff, just to the point, you know, job skills. And so I created this platform, and we have a community where I provide training and checklists and things like that for people. Again, always focused on the practical. It's not law review. It's not contract law that you learned in law school. It's really just job instructions. And then I also have a conference coming up that's going to further expand on how to contract concepts. So it's the How to Contract Conference. We've got sold 200 tickets so far. We've got 15 speakers, and it's all how to draft and negotiate an assignment provision, how to draft and negotiate a software license, how to draft and negotiate indemnity provisions. So it's very much instructional lessons on how to do the things we do every day.
Well, let's circle back a little bit, because I don't want to gloss over this. Tell us a little bit about how, on the platform, how is the training provided? Are you doing it in video format? Are you doing it in group sessions, live sessions? How is that training delivered?
Yeah, so it's right now I have a community only, and in the community, it's structured around a weekly job aid. So it's recorded videos, and then there's, as I said, checklists, other things each week.
Resources.
Other resources that people get. And then I also have a community on LinkedIn that's only for members of that community. And we answer each other's questions. We give each other support. We celebrate each other's, you know, victories. And it's a wonderful community of about 300 people who are all focused on helping each other learn about the practical aspects of contracting.
And do you also cover, you know, some of the tools or resources that one might use in providing, you know, contract law services?
Yeah. So there was a lot of interest in talking about contract technology, because it's a big part of our practice now.
Because I can imagine, let me just cut to the chase, though, that whereas it used to be back in the day, you know, it was just way back in the day, it was just typed document, then became, you know, a word processing document. Now I suspect that there's all kinds of resources and tools that you can use to streamline and automate, and at least the building of the product.
Yeah, there, it's the technology out there is absolutely amazing. And so we've done a few things to help our, to help the community. And one of them is we started something called the Contract Tech Showcase. And Flo Nicholas, who is part of How to Contract, has is the host, and she talks with a different contract vendor about their products. So we offer that. And then we'll also, I sometimes share information about Contract Tech in my posts. So it's definitely part of the community. Mm-hmm. But my main focus is always on contract fundamentals and helping people learn how to do the job skills of what we do. So the Contract Tech is more a one aspect of it. But mine is really this, the mission is really focused around the job training.
Now, it, from the perspective of our audience, solo and small firm practitioners, how can they benefit from this platform? Would it be expanding potentially their practice area or getting smarter within the contracts law practice area? Or would they be helping to provide these resources to clients of their own? How could they take advantage of this?
Yeah, no, that's, and what I, one of the things I love about the How to Contract platform is the diversity of people who benefit from it. Mm-hmm. So we have, for example, I'm having the conference, 64% of the people coming to our conference have 6 or more years of experience with contracts. So even though my courses and my materials are good for students and for business people to learn, because it's written in plain English, I don't use legalese, there's not a lot of citations, mm-hmm. just tells the facts with no fluff. But it's also great for people who have been practicing a while and maybe only have, for people who do a lot of contracts, this is a chance for them to refresh and think about issues that they don't think about very often, except when it comes up, and it's a chance to really think through and talk to other people about it. But also, I have a lot of people who are, for example, litigators or regulatory lawyers who don't do contracts that often. And so they use this to really build up their foundational knowledge about contracts and how we do what we do.
Well, it's fascinating because it clearly has, you know, value to a whole host of different, you know, types of users, not just attorneys themselves, but the folks that attorneys come in contact with. I could see this, you know, frankly, as being a great referral, not source, but something I could refer my clients to that would bring value to them. You know, for instance, I'm an estate planner. So I see people who with their own businesses, you know, general contractors, landscapers, you know, regular folks who need some help understanding the contract world. And this would be a great way for me to bring value to them is refer them to the How to Contract platform.
Definitely. And I appreciate that you think so. It's we have a lot of people like that. We have a lot of, you know, administrators of small businesses who work with leases and purchase orders and sales. And there's really nowhere to learn the job skills for doing contracts. Because even if you go to paralegal school, it's they focus more on the litigation side of things, the statutory, the case law. And but then how do you prepare an amendment? You know, who's teaching that? And that's really what I try to do.
Well, it's the quintessential challenge. It'd be, you know, just law school doesn't really teach you how to practice law, you know, and, you know, same thing with paralegal school training gives you some skill sets, but the meat and potatoes of how to get things done is really a practical element. And platforms such as How to Contract develop that training and that skill to the point where people actually could get things done. And in that really what we're all about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's with the change in the legal field where it used to be when I was starting out, almost all lawyers started out in law firms or in government jobs where they received a lot of training. And that's not the dynamic anymore. We have so many new law graduates who are opening up their firms on their own right out of law school, whether they want to or not, it's a reality, or going in-house and not receiving sufficient training. So this is my effort to help everyone who didn't get the kind of quality training that I got when I went to Morrison & Foerster and was in other firms, to really have that opportunity to learn from somebody who has been there and done that.
Well, frankly, the whole reason for this podcast is to bridge that gap and to fill the void where, you know, as I've said when I'm on my soapbox, that law schools and bar associations aren't providing. And this is a perfect example of how the private world is recognizing there's a need and you are filling it, and with great success. So I love that. Tell us just quickly before we wrap up here, your conference, is that a in-person conference or virtual or both? Or
when
is it?
It's a virtual only conference.
Okay.
And it's going to be January 13th and 14th. I priced it up to be within reason for, you know, solos and small business lawyers who don't have big budgets. So it's $495 for 8 CLE hours in about 20 to 25 states. And then I also have discount tickets for students are only $95, and government, nonprofit, and education are $195.
Oh,
so
terrific.
It's a great opportunity for people to really get some practical skills.
And we're going to have that link in the show notes, howtocontract.com/conference, if you're just listening. But you can go there to get tickets. Also, that's, you know, howtocontract.com is the website. That'll be in the show notes as well. Is that the primary way that people should reach out to you if they want to chat about this, or should they look for you on LinkedIn, or what do you prefer?
LinkedIn is great because I have been posting every day. I'm up to 486 days in a row. I will continue to do so. Yeah. So I'm on there every day, and I love engaging with people in the comments. So you can direct message me there or comment on one of my posts. And I try to respond to every post or every comment because I just love talking about this stuff. So you can easily find me on LinkedIn.
Laura, it has been great having you here on The Law Entrepreneur. I wish you the best of luck. It's a great story. It's a great product. And I said, I wish you the best of luck with it.
Oh, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, thanks for being a guest on The Law Entrepreneur. Well, how about that? That's a wrap for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors once again, as usual: Daylight by Market Circle, Spotlight Branding, Ruby, as in Ruby Receptionists, and our newest sponsor, Security Plus. If you have a chance, swing on by our website at www.lawentrepreneur.com. You can check out a bunch of information and resources there. And if that doesn't satisfy your needs, swing on by our Facebook page or Twitter page. You can find those just by simply searching for The Law Entrepreneur. And if you'd be so kind, I would greatly appreciate it if you go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and an honest review. If you find this podcast is helpful and that you're getting value out of it, it does help with our visibility and ensures that we're going to be there for another 5 years or so, as this has been quite the run. And I'm greatly appreciative of your interest in The Law Entrepreneur.